This month's podcast sponsor is StormForge. StormForge's Kubernetes performance testing and optimization platform is the easiest way to ensure your applications behave the way you want them to, while cutting out unnecessary resources and time spent manually tuning. In alignment with this, StormForge is asking for your help reducing the amount of unused cloud resources, making both a financial and environmental impact in the world today. We want you to help make that impact with us. So visit https://stormforge.io/podcast. That's stormforge.io/podcast. To learn more about how you can help erase cloud waste and take the cloud waste pledge. While you're there, try out the free tier, the machine learning backed service, to start saving resources and getting better performance today.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. Today, I have a friend of mine. This is Austin Parker. He's the principal developer advocate for Lightstep. Welcome, Austin Parker.
Hi. It's great to be here.
It's great having you, man. We were in a panel together. I'm like, I like this dude. I'm like, I want to have him on the show. And I like Lightstep. I like Lightstep for a bunch of years. And we're going to get into that, folks. I kind of want to talk about your journey, dude. I want to talk about like how you started computing in general and just like all the way to where you are now.
Wow. So yeah, first off, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me again. I love to talk to people about this stuff. I really got started pretty young. Like I was a computer nerd growing up, right? So a lot of kids like to play sports or do things exciting like that. And I decided to stay inside and play around on an old Apple II. And that got me into first program I ever wrote was I wrote a database in BASIC to keep track of baseball cards. Because I wanted to see quickly what I had. So
where did you grow up, out of curiosity, if you don't mind me asking?
When or where?
Where?
Eastern Kentucky.
Okay.
Southern boy. Culturally Southern, I guess.
We talk about the baseball cards. And what was your team?
Reds.
You were so you like to Cincinnati.
Yeah, that's like
Reds.
The Pete Rose era, yeah.
Okay. All right. Big Red Machine.
Yeah, Big Red Machine. So yeah. I remember I saw King Griffey Jr. when he was going through the Reds before Seattle. Or was it after Seattle? Been a while. But okay. So I got started really early with that. And, you know, honestly, for the longest time, funny enough, like for the longest time, I didn't want it to be a career. I was very, I mean, this was like the 80s, 90s, right? And there was a very negative stereotype about nerds and you didn't want to be a nerd. And so I kind of spent a lot of time in my 20s trying to do things other than computers and never really lost the, you know, habit, never really lost the nerve for it. So at some point, things worked out. I had the opportunity to kind of go back and finish college in my late 20s and got out of there, got into a software job. And that's actually, it was a company called Apprenda, which if you are a longtime cloud native observer, you might recognize the name Apprenda. If you've been to like the second KubeCon, you might have a t-shirt with that name on it. But I got into Apprenda as like a software developer and test, and then went from there into DevOps, really. We didn't have a, you know, DevOps program or really a lot of, it was very much a siloed thing, right? There were QA and ops people on one side, there were devs on the other side. They would, you know, write a bunch of changes, throw the code over the wall, and it was our job to kind of run it. So that's what kind of got me down this DevOps observability path. Apprenda, unfortunately, no longer with us as a going corporate concern. And I joined Lightstep several years ago to originally work on open source. It went into a different direction, right? Like decided, well, hey, let's try this DevRel thing out. And here I am.
Incredible. And so like, what drew you to like observability and like distributed tracing and all of that? Like what drove you to that?
So the,
anybody can go be, you know, software developer, you know, you can work on the infrastructure, work on the operations, but there's like, there's a special person, you know, cause again, it's hard, you know, my history, I was sysdig, right? And so it's like, you know, it's always about like telemetry. It's, you know, aspects and being able to correlate things to like things that SREs care about. Right. But like, it takes a special person to like, you know, get involved with that. Like what drew you to it? Let's go that route.
So I think that ironically enough, it was my time at Apprenda that really made me understand the difficulty of not having it. Right. So from an early age, right, the first thing that got me interested in using computers as a tool, right, was I want to keep track of stuff. I have this information and I need to make it accessible to me somehow, right? I have these giant boxes of baseball cards. I want to know which ones do I have, which ones do I not have, so when I open a new pack, I can find it, right? And that desire to use the computing as a tool to help you understand information and understand information at scale really stuck with me. And it became really personal when I was at Apprenda, because I eventually wound up helping, being one of the primary maintainers really of sort of our entire dev test QA per release lifecycle. And a huge part of that for us was these very long and painful test runs. We had, Apprenda was a platform as a service that ran on .NET and Java, and it was really, you know, this big enterprise product. It was extremely customizable, and well over 80% of the tests for this were kind of integration tests, right? You had to deploy the entire thing, and you had to deploy it to a lot of really specific configurations, and you had to have a bunch of, we had this whole, you know, 20 by 10 matrix of features that had to be enabled and disabled, and right, to cover all these different test cases. And this was, you know, this was not too long ago, but it was long enough ago that we were testing on like Windows Server 2008, you know, Windows Server 8.1, oh, you know, I think CentOS like 5 or 6, you know, really kind of older setups where you didn't have a lot of the nice automation tools you do now. So the whole thing is held together with spit and baling wire and prayer. And the worst thing was, is you have these, you know, 16-hour test runs, and it's the middle of the night and something breaks and you don't know about it until the next day. And you come in the next morning, everyone's under the gun to get a release done, and whoops, turns out the something crashed in 3 a.m. We don't know why, but it wipes out that entire test cycle. So now you have to do it all over again. And now we can't, you know, you can't make progress. So I really started to understand, because it personally affected me, how valuable, how essential having that kind of data is and that kind of insight is into your system, into your software, and how useful it is to be able to take that data and those insights and sort of funnel them back into the team, right? It's not just about, I want to know what's going on to scratch some itch. It's like, this is hurting everyone's life and the way we make decisions, because we don't have this information. We can't communicate it in reasonable ways. Everyone gets super mad because you're yelling, you know, people are yelling at each other. There was extremely stressful to try to run systems in that sort of data vacuum.
Can I detach from that a little bit and kind of, do you think that being good at like developer advocacy takes a certain amount of time in the field? What I mean by that is like being an operator, getting to deal with like outages and be able to say, look, I can sympathize with you and I'm going to write an article or I'm going to do a talk about this because I've literally got shrapnel from all the, you know, dealing with, you know, the apprentices of the world, or, you know, doing like SRE work for Kubernetes or anything like that. Would you say that's good? It's a useful thing to have.
I want to draw a distinction, because I think, is it useful? Yeah, it's absolutely useful. Like lived experiencing things is for yourself is maybe the best way to be able to talk about them. But I wouldn't say it's a requirement, right? Like I think you can be an excellent developer advocate even if you don't have the battle scars, because we're all going to, you know, you're, because that's going to give you a unique perspective too, right? It shouldn't, I think it's one of the things that we do ourselves a disservice in the tech industry by almost requiring everyone to go through all this trauma of like, well, I did it this shitty way, and so now you have to do it this shitty way too, or you're not a real dev, or you're not, you know, this or that or the other. And it's one, it's kind of self-defeating because it means that you're putting a bunch of people into a situation where they're incentivized to not change things for the better, or to not listen, I guess, when it comes down to it, right? They, you know, if we put such a high value on effectively hazing people into the industry by making them go through negative experiences, then one, that drives a lot of people out because they don't necessarily get it, right? They don't get that, hey, it's okay, you're supposed to go through this. And two, I just don't think that it's a super healthy way to consider a job or an industry or a role, right? Like, taking the pager shouldn't be like this scary thing. Responding to an incident or an outage or whatever shouldn't be like traumatic. And because of the way it is, and, you know, this goes to a lot of things. It influences our language, right? There was a really interesting thread on Twitter the other day by, I think, Ian Coldwater about the prevalence of military language in like red teaming and in security communications, where you ask yourself, well, why does that happen, right? How did we get to the point where it's like everything is, you know, where cybersecurity and security in general is often described in these complex military, or not even complex, these sort of blunt military metaphors. You know, you're at war with attackers, you're doing defense in depth, right? And that leads to a lot of things. It kind of sets people's minds in a certain way. And I think it gets reinforced by the fact that a lot, you know, you look around, a lot of like ex-military people tend to go into security. Is there a reason for that? Well, maybe it's because it feels like something that they're comfortable with because of things like this. Yeah, it's something to keep in mind, right? Something to consider.
So let's get back into like just observability and distributed tracing in general. Like, tell me about the core tenets of, let's just talk about observability in general. Like, tell me the core tenets of somebody, you know, of how you do this well.
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things that I think is important to understand about observability is that, to me at least, observability is a lot more about sort of the culture you have around understanding systems. I think, you know, let's step back for a second. I work for a vendor. I have a lot of friends that work for vendors, and we all have, you know, our marketing lines on this. And I don't think that there's anyone that is out there, you know, everyone's going to have their own particular spin on like, what is observability? And I think it's silly for everyone to go to war or go to the mat over, you know, marketing terminology, because at the end of the day, observability is a state more than, you know, a set of checkboxes. It's, I have this potentially infinitely complex system, and I want to be able to ask infinite questions about that system. And I want to get useful answers too, right? That's the part that tooling helps with. And then the next part of it, once you've got your infinite system and your infinite questions and you've got your infinite answers, then you want to do something about them. And that's where the cultural part of observability comes in. And that's where you're using all this data, you're connecting it from, you know, engineers to product people to CS to executives to whoever. And you're using that to really drive decision making and to let people feel like they have control over what's going on. And that creates a virtuous cycle where it's like, oh, now that we can do this, we want to keep doing this, right? We want to do more of this. We want to get more and more observability. We want to make sure that when it's 3 a.m. and something crashes, we know why. And we don't have to spend a bunch of time trying to figure out why. Preferably, we would have a tool that we could just say like, hey, this crashed. Why?
And so like, and again, I think that's how, you know, from a vendor perspective, right? That's how we're able to deploy our goods. But I think what I see out there as well is I think it's a cultural shift. It's, you know, it's where like, you know, application owners need to understand there's like key things that you have to kind of tool to be able to ensure this, like, and especially with something like cloud native and cloud app, it's too super difficult to kind of understand that because it's completely different than just for something running in a monolithic state at an enterprise level. It's just a completely different thing. So yeah, like the first, I'm sure you spent
layers of abstraction.
I'm sure you spent at least the first couple of years at Lightstep just talking about how to do, you know, like they, because folks were like, I don't, what does this mean? Like, you know, what is, you know, latency? What are like, you know, percentiles? Why should I care about that? You know, and stuff like that. Yeah. So,
yeah, I think that it's, you have to understand the value. And I think part of the hard part about understanding the value sometimes is because we approach observability as, there's a couple ways you can approach it. One, right? One is looking at what you already have, right? Well, we all have logs. We're all pretty comfortable with, well, you know, I say we're all pretty comfortable with logs, but for as widely used as they are, they're also like incredibly, you know, the battle for structured logging still continues, right? Like we certainly haven't reached this point of, hey, everybody is using structured logging or everyone's using the same logging format. Too many people, I know people maybe listening to this, in recent memory have probably grepped through stuff on a remote server because that's, you know, they're not aggregating stuff, they're not collecting it and centralizing it. when you start from that point, right, where people are looking at this, and I think this is a challenge that I don't know if we've actually done as well as we can as an industry on, but you start out by saying, okay, you tell people that maybe are having this sort of struggle with logging, right, where it's like, I don't even understand logging that well, or I know we could be doing better, but we're not doing great. And you show them Prometheus, and then you show them tracing, and then you come back and say, like, well, all right, all that stuff, that's junk. None of that's actually observability, right? We do a lot to discourage folks, I think, inadvertently, by looking at sort of this leading edge of, hey, here's all the people that are doing it extremely right by our metrics, and that's what you should be going for. Meanwhile, it's so hard to actually do any of this stuff in a useful way that we have thousands and thousands of people that are stuck back here on just like, I have some logs, those are text files, and those get rotated every 24 hours. And when someone calls me and tells me the app is down, then I go start like searching through those, right? And this is the thing that I think, this is one reason that I think OpenTelemetry can be very useful, because it can start to address some of these systemic problems.
Yeah, because I mean, folks think that, you know, it's like you have Prometheus, I have my metrics, and, you know, I'm exporting this data, but then it's like, okay, that's just a ton of data, or I have a ton of logs, right? And I need to correlate it. And the distributed tracing is yet another kind of, you know, tooling piece that's kind of getting you there. The interesting thing about tracing, and what I, you know, I love the OpenTelemetry project. I think it's a fantastic. So I had, you know, Liz DeGray on last year and last season. And, you know, again, that is the high watermark of like, you know, what a good, you know, SRE kind of practice is and person is. And, you know, it's interesting, like OpenTelemetry, it's, you know, it's obviously a lot of cool things. It's, you know, that folks are using it, but kind of give me the, why, if I'm, hey, I'm an SRE just starting on the field, why should I care about OpenTelemetry in general?
Yeah. So I think the thing to keep in mind with OpenTelemetry is it's one of those stories in technology where how we got here is more important than what we're doing, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So if you think back even 5 years ago, 6 years ago, if you wanted to go and you wanted to, you say, I need something, right? I need metrics or logs or traces or whatever, you had really two broad options. One was to try the open source route. And you had tools like Jaeger, you were starting, you know, Prometheus was out there, Elasticsearch, well, was more open source then maybe than it is today. But you had these options, but the thing that always held you back was, you know, the support, right? Like you needed all these different plugins. You needed something for your specific, you know, it's like, oh, I got to get host metrics out of here. I got to get, you know, my syslog stuff. I need this particular thing for my SQL client to trace that and my web framework to trace that. And it was a lot of work and a lot of it wasn't done for you. It was a lot of like, I got to go and manually write this stuff. And so maybe you look at a vendor, the vendor space, and you see a bunch of different companies that all said, look, it's easy. You take, you know, you pay us whatever, you drop this agent in on a host, and it does it all for you. It'll get your logs, it'll get your trace APM, it'll do your metrics, it'll do this, that, and the other. And literally every vendor has their own one of these, right? Like, and depend, you know, you go and maybe a few years after that and some of this stuff starts to be open sourced and you go and look at the code bases and you start to realize that a lot of the code for the actual, you know, how are we scraping this data looks very similar, right? Because there's only really one way to instrument SQL client, JDBC, right? There's really only one way to get stuff out of, you know, proc. It all looks the same at the end of the day, but we've got all this duplicated work going on across the industry to make a bunch of proprietary agents that it's silly. It really was silly, and I don't think anybody liked it. I don't think customers liked it because I don't think, you know, the people that are paying the checks or signing the checks certainly don't like it because it's like, well, we can't get out, right? We can't stop using this company or that company because we've deployed them everywhere. If you don't have the budget for it, then you're kind of stuck back in a prehistoric age where it's like, well, I have to do all this work myself. I'm spending more time trying to instrument my software and understand, you know, and do the plumbing to see what's going on rather than actually fixing problems in my stuff. And I think if you were a, you know, a developer, someone that's interested in instrumentation, someone maybe is, you know, creating things like Kubernetes or framework code or open source libraries, and you have users that say, well, I want to monitor this. How do you choose, right? Do you write and integrate? Do you integrate with this or that or the other? No, you don't. You can't integrate with one proprietary thing and not the other proprietary thing. The maturity level of a lot of these open source projects was different. I mean, now in 2021, it's easy to say, yeah, Prometheus basically, you know, has won for some certain definition of one.
For metrics, plugins. Though, like for metrics, yeah.
But yeah. Even with that, like if you go to Prometheus, you know, Prometheus exec, and you look at like how many of those, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't export native Prometheus. It's just the community has stepped up and said, like, well, we're gonna treat Prometheus as the lingua franca for metrics, and we're gonna write the exporter that lets you scrape, you know, whatever, right? Your F5 big IP. Yeah. OpenTelemetry is really the story of how all those different stakeholders, those end users, the vendors, the open source people got together and said, it's really silly for us to duplicate our work like this. And the goal of OpenTelemetry in 5 years, if I'm still in OpenTelemetry in 5 years, and I hope I will be, and I hope everything still goes great. But 5 years from now, I want to come back on here and say, you know, if someone asks what's OpenTelemetry, say, I'm going to say you're already using it because it's just the standard. It's right. Built into everything. Did you kubectl apply a deployment? Congratulations, you're using OpenTelemetry, right? Did you spin up MySQL? Congratulations, you're using OpenTelemetry. Are you using Express or ASP.NET Core or Spring, right? Congratulations, it's already there.
Meaning, like it's basically like the tracing functions are already deployed as part of like just the underlying kind of framework for anything. Like
for anything,
and it's agnostic to any vendor because they're contributing to OpenTelemetry as the basis versus, you know, having to do like offshoots and all of this. Like
right,
that you're okay. So
that's the goal, right? That OpenTelemetry just becomes a part of the cloud native ecosystem, so that if you're writing cloud native software, your frameworks have this built in, and not just for traces either, but also for metrics and eventually for logs, so that the three big things that OpenTelemetry provides. One is the specification standards work, right? So we've done a lot of work over the past couple of years to define semantic conventions for things like, well, what, you know, what should the metric name be when for garbage collection? What should the metric name be, you know, for memory utilization or disk free, right? So once there's an open standard on that, all of these other tools that are doing analysis on the raw data can start to adopt that and start to become smarter, right? Because they know no matter what, you know, whatever it is, it's going to send me CPU data in this format. Beyond that, right, the second big part of this is, you know, the sort of this API work, right? Creating an API, a pretty low level API, admittedly, for creating traces and metrics and at some point associating like logs with that. Or and then the third thing is really this idea of context in that underpinning the traces and metrics and logs, so that, you know, when I'm in a process and I'm creating a trace, it has a context associated with it. If I create, when I
like, as in, like if you're running in Kubernetes, it's in this pod, in this cluster, and all
right, like that's all that sort of all those labels really that affix it. But also that you could use to associate, hey, these metric measurements are from this specific request versus that specific request, right? So it's not only do I know what was the, you know, maybe I see the error rate go up on something because I have a metric for that, I could actually see the exact request that it comes back to rather than using like exemplars or other things that are sort of correlated versus causal relationships. Yep. And the same thing with my logs, where it's, and then so that, that gives you this idea of like, oh, now I have all of my data interconnected. You know, that that's sort of the idea behind the software side of this. And then the third thing I think is the idea of the tools around it. Mm-hmm. So the tools are things like the OpenTelemetry collector, right? And also the OpenTelemetry automatic instrumentation. So the collector is like a Swiss Army knife. It lets you take data in a bunch of different formats and then translate it into the OpenTelemetry format, or take
data that have to inject it in your code to be able to get it, right? Because that's the normal like function. Because if you think about like, and I'm talking APM, we're not going to go into metrics on this whole thing, but like APM functions to me, like where like you have to inject your code. Like you think about, you know, vendors that inject it there, inject something in your code, or you had to like, you know, push it out to some type of either Prometheus or like StatsD or something like that, right? And so versus like you said, that instant, that collector function, and then that instant instrumentation, like APM in the past was just so like it was so involved. But like again, if so, talk to me again about that, just like that wrinkle with OpenTelemetry, like with collector, like I want to understand that because that's really cool stuff.
Yeah. So the collector and the automatic instrumentation, they don't necessarily work hand in hand, but they're really part of the same story. So right now, you know, the APM part of this, right, the getting your code traced, that's what the automatic instrumentation does. And before, you'd have to use a proprietary, you know, agent for this, something that your vendor gave you. Now what you can do is you can take that a package and you can install it. I mean, it depends on the language, right? The great thing I think about OpenTelemetry is when one of the decisions we made when we started the project was, you should, you know, if you're writing C sharp, then you should respect the conventions, right? You should respect the conventions of your language. So your API should feel like a C sharp API. If you're running Java, it should feel like a Java API. If you're using Go, it should feel like a Go API. We don't want one thing for everyone. We want stuff that feels natural for you. So if you're using C sharp, then, and you want automatic instrumentation, right? You have an ASP.NET app and you want it traced. Cool. Right now you can go in, you can add some usings, you can add a little bit of code into your setup, your startup.cs file, add it in through dependency injection. And now every request you make is traced. Every time your app calls to the database through, you know, entity framework, that's traced. You talk to Redis, that's traced, right? For Java, we have a similar thing. Now, you can do it either by importing it, and this is the great thing, is it's not the same way for everyone. You know, for Java, it's like, okay, well, we can throw a Java agent in through the JVM invocation, right? You dash dash Java agent. You download the jar, you put it into the class path through that, you give it some config through, you know, dash D, blah, 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 and it works.
And there's a convention for it. That's the whole point of this.
Right. It's all standard.
Right. You don't have to go back to a vendor and say, extend this, because if you want to, you can take it and grow it out. Is that it, like?
Yes, you can take it. You can. It's all. And this is, and everything I'm talking about is 100% open source. You can go look at the source code for this. You can make pull requests. You can write documentation. Please, God help me with my documentation.
By the way, everyone, we'll have a link to the OpenTelemetry.
OpenTelemetry.io.
OpenTelemetry.io, and we'll have to get so people can contribute, because again, and hopefully this season I really want to impart this contribution, because like a lot of folks are taking, you know, we could probably spend an hour on that right there, is like, you know, taking this, you know, a lot of these, the hearts and souls of a lot of maintainers writing this, and you're taking advantage of it, but give back, either write documentation or come back with issues, and or come back and like write new specs and conventions and all of that fun stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get off my soapbox real quick.
Oh, you're cool, man.
Yeah.
The second part is, you know, once you've the other half of that from the auto-instrumentation is the collector. Because the collector can kind of work like one of those host-based agents where you put that on your, you know, you put it in your EC2 instance or you run it as a sidecar and it can gather those resources, things like what pod am I in? What node am I on? What's my CPU, you know, what's memory utilization like, right? And your automatic instrumentations sends that data to the collector. And this is the really cool part, is the collector is also extensible, right? So there are exporters on this. You can send it to any number of companies. So not only send it to like open source backends like Jaeger or Zipkin for tracing or Prometheus for metrics, but you can send it to anyone that comes in and writes a plugin, right? Or you can send it out through the OpenTelemetry format, which a lot of people are starting to natively accept. So no more like, oh, we went with big vendor A 5 years ago and everything is done in that format. We can't switch because it's just too big. Now it can be cool. We put OpenTelemetry everywhere and we are no longer locked into anything.
Got it.
I've seen like in the past 6 months alone, I've seen like two or three like new open source projects or similar ones come out like in this space, right? Things like Tempo from Grafana, and there was one I saw just the other day. I can't remember the name of it, but I saw another like, you know, tracing plus metrics thing that's built on open source stuff like Prometheus and Grafana. And their whole thing is like, yeah, we accept OpenTelemetry. So if you can take your data, get it into OpenTelemetry format, it'll go to all these different things, and you no longer have to worry about, is this going to be the best thing for me tomorrow? You can just put it into OTel and sort of forget about it.
Got it. And so riddle me this then. So we have OpenTelemetry again as a convention. It's awesome. It's open source. Somebody could just, you know, kick the tires right now that the instrumentation, the collector aspect. What's Lightstep? What is Lightstep and what does it do for me? Like, how does that fit in this mix for anybody listening and watching?
So Lightstep is a little background on Lightstep. We were actually, our founders were at Google back in the day. They helped build Dapper, which if you've heard of that, was really one of the first extremely large scale distributed tracing systems. And we also helped build Monarch, which is one of their time series metrics database. So the original idea with Lightstep is, hey, we've got the technology called Dapper, and it's very cool, and it's actually extremely applicable, right? If you think all the way back to my sort of like 3 a.m. Apprenda what happened calls, the hard part about it is when you're kind of even 6 hours after an incident, or especially in the middle of an incident, you want to have a bunch of data at hand and you want an easy way to see what's changed. I mean, because things generally don't break for no reason. You know, there's some sort of contributing factor or whatnot. So the question that LICEP is really trying to answer for people is, what has changed? What's changed in your system? And how we do this is we take metric and tracing data and logs. We feed all that into LICEP, and we provide a lot of features built on sort of the confluence of these things. So in kind of the old fashioned way. Is it on-prem?
Like I'm trying, again, somebody like
wants. It's a combination. So it's a combination. There's, without getting too much into the weeds, there's three ways you can use LICEP. One is you can use it through our community tier, which is free and has some rate limits on it. And you can try out all the stuff I'm about to talk about. The second is our teams. And that's for people that don't want to run their own infrastructure, right? Like people that are kind of growing, you know, they're going to prod. They want something that's kind of pay as you go and they don't want to be under a contract. And then we have an on-prem or enterprise option that has some options for moving parts of this on-premise. But primarily it's a SaaS product, right? The actual backend is all SaaS. The basic experience is this. You have, you know, your application, you're sending traces and you're sending metrics. You see something on a dashboard. You see squiggly line go up or squiggly line go down. You say, that's interesting. So you click on that and we pop up a little thing that says, what's changed? You click on that. What LICEP is able to do for you is we were able to kind of correlate and analyze 100% of the unsampled trace data that's kind of coming from your application. We're able to look at all of that. We're able to look at these time series metrics, and we're able to not only look at like what's wrong in the service that you clicked on, but we're also able to analyze the dependency graph of that service and drill down to like, okay, maybe I'm, you know, the way I like to describe it is maybe I'm like a front end dev, right? And I get paged because my route, you know, my checkout route is failing a lot. So I can, rather than having to know, you know, back before all this, I could look at the logs. Maybe I could go in and I could check in my browser and I can open, you know, Web Inspector and say like, oh, yep, that's a 500 or it's only a 500 sometimes. But who knows where that's coming from? There could be 200 services in that request chain from that API all the way back to the database and back. And then think of all the other things that could confound this, because, you know, if you're in this big, modern, fast-paced dev environment, there could be feature flags, there could be people doing chaos experiments, there could be, you know, weird sort of network flaps and other outages based on cloud weirdness, for lack of a better term. There's too much information for me as an individual dev to really understand like every part of this chain and be able to figure out like, well, is this a problem I need to worry about or is this a problem someone else needs to worry about? Now, my boss might be right in my butt about it because I'm the one getting alerted, I'm getting paged. So I need to be able to give him an answer. In LICEP, rather than, you know, kind of not knowing or having to go dig through 20 different run books, you go to the graph, you see, that's interesting. You click on it, say, what's changed? We're able to look through the traces of that request and find interesting things that are happening, even if they're not in the at the service where you saw the error. So you saw the error on the front end, but maybe the actual problem is in like a checkout service or an external API that's like 10 or 15 hops away in the service graph. We can find that, identify it for you, and say, hey, we think this is we think this is the contributing, right? We're not, a lot of people like to talk about AI and things like that. And I vehemently disagree with the idea of like calling this stuff AI. It's statistical analysis. I've looked at the code. It is like advanced stats, but it's still just stats.
But it's based on experience. Computers are really good at doing stats. And that's the whole point though. It's based on kind of your experience. If you think about your founders, right? If you think about like, you know, these are folks that were looking at a ton of data from different huge systems and stuff like that. So this is practical. Again, AI is only as good as the practical experience or statistical stuff is only by the practical experience put behind it. And so like I, you know, That's awesome, though, being able to like just call out, hey, this is, you know, out of whack. And here's what we think the issue is based on all the practical experience we have. Right. So,
yeah, that's we're going to give you a lot of the we're going to give you all the options. Right. The whole idea, and this goes back to what I was saying really early, is it's not just about the computer telling you there's a problem. It's about having this cycle of being able to ask these questions, because you might find, you know, maybe you. We might be wrong. Who knows? Like, we're going to show you something and we're going to tell you like, yeah, this is strongly correlated, or hey, there's this thing that pops up more frequently here than in other places. But that might only be like, that might be the proximate cause, right? That might be like, oh, that's why this is going wrong. But why is that going wrong? Right. And so that starts you down another, you know, like, okay, now I'm going to go look at this. And you can keep asking those arbitrary questions and getting those answers. And that's what Lightship is doing for you. It is a force multiplier. It is a, hey, I don't have to grep across 25 different pods. I don't have to go wake someone up. I don't have to go read Confluence for an hour to understand like this chain of dependencies or whatever is going on here. I just start clicking around, looking at data, exploring that data, and learning for myself, right? And I think that's a better way to do it. You know, the reason I'm at Lightstep primarily is because when I talked to someone here years ago, and like in 15 minutes, you know, they kind of pitched this whole vision of what this technology could do. And I thought to myself, I would be so much happier if during all of those like middle of the night or in the morning afters at Apprenda, when something broke and all we had were a bunch of graphs and a bunch of log files to go through. If I had had this, oh, it would have saved me so much time. I'd have been so much happier. It would have changed my life. And that's what I'm here to do now. I'm here to tell people about how great it can be when you do have these sort of tools.
Let's move on now, right? Let's talk about deserted island DevOps. Okay, I'm going to give you some background. So I'm pretty much family with Ian Coldwater, right? They are one of my really deep friends, right? Mm-hmm. And they're like, I'm doing a talk here. And so when I had them on, you know, the podcast, we talked about you. And so like, there was like, there's always these like, you know, it's the cloud native world is very small. It's a small world, right? And so I've always heard of you, right? And I'm like, oh, you know, and you've heard of me. And it was always like, all right, let's talk. And I'm like, this is the coolest thing ever. So give me, everybody who's listening to this, this is the coolest thing. Tell me about the way you got the idea for this, for Animal Crossing as a way, as a conference mechanism. Because it's amazing, dude. It's amazing.
So I'll give you the more abbreviated. I could do a day on this alone. The abbreviated version is, you know, this was last year, last March, end of February, end of March. And it was that kind of the first 2 weeks of like global, like, shit, this is going to be bad lockdown. And I'm looking at my schedule and, you know, everything's getting canceled. All my talks are, you know, all the conferences are getting canceled. Everyone's just stuck inside. And, you know, hey, Kismet, Animal Crossing had come out. And everyone was playing Animal Crossing. Why wouldn't you? It's a game where you get to like virtually travel and it's cute and it keeps you from thinking about how awful the world outside is. So at some point I made this, there's an editor in there where you can make your own designs. I made a Lightstep logo and I put it on something and I was like, haha, what if you did a conference in Animal Crossing? And like four people or five people liked it on Twitter. And that was kind of like all I really needed. That was like, maybe this will work. So I put up a landing page for it on April 1st last year as a, like, you know, here's this thing coming and here's the register here for more information. And my thought process kind of was, all right, this is a really silly idea, but it's technically feasible. To have a conference in Animal Crossing and stream it out. And if I put this up and no one signs up for it, then okay, we tried. Or then it's like, this is a fun April Fools, right? Who would ever do something stupid? And then like 100 people signed up. right? Like the first day. And so I turn around, I go and I go back. I'm like, 100 people signed up for this. What do we do? What do I do? And they're like, oh, I guess you have to do it now. And I'm like, I guess I do. So that is kind of how it started. 30
there was later, a high turnout to that. I mean, you're talking about 100 days.
14,000 people watched.
This is incredible. Here's why it's incredible. Okay. Again, it's where people these days, again, we have a pandemic. It's like, you know, there was that Super Bowl thing. Oh, life gave you lemons and, you know, oh, like that, you know, like commercial. But it was like, man, you turn the thing around. It's very similar to what I had to do with the podcast. It was like, look, I'm not going to go out there. I'm not going to see my friends. I'm not going to be able to do that. You got to turn it around and be like, I'm going to do something that's going to just, you know, I'm not going to do the usual, like go and do a webinar and do a meetup level thing. It's like, let's do something fun, cute, that it's different than what's going on there. It took so much bravery. I feel like a lot
of people started podcasts because of the pandemic.
But the entertainment aspect of it, like, look, the best talks or the best conferences, if you think about like rejects or like, you know, some of the best keynotes at KubeCons are always one that entertain beyond the technology, make people think.
Yeah.
Think about what Ian presented at yours. It was, you know, it was great. Like, you know, and so long story short, I was super like, this guy's awesome. I you know, props to doing Deserted Island DevOps. I thought it was amazing.
Wow. Dude. Yeah. The call for speakers is up for Deserted Island DevOps 2021. You can find that linked off of the website, and Deserted Island DevOps 2021 will happen again on April 30th. So
this is going to air in March, everyone. So I'll definitely have a link to it.
The CFP might still be open by the time you listen to this. It closes like the second week of March or second or third week of March. So it'll either be about to close or it will just close and you'll miss your opportunity. But you should still come to Deserted Island DevOps 2021. It's absolutely free. There's no registration. A lot of it is really just like me saying, well, if I wanted to go to a virtual event and not feel like I wasted my day, what would I do? And that's kind of the motivating factor for a lot of the decisions about how it gets run. So yeah, no. Yeah, it's going to be a different experience, but I think you can go back and watch what it was like last year on YouTube, and it's going to be pretty similar to that, I think.
We'll have a link to both last year and this year. So. Yeah. I want to talk about something, and you know, we kind of glanced at this, and we were talking preparing the interview. I'm a wrestling fan as well, so I mean, sometimes you got to kind of hold it, you know, inside and stuff like that because of the, you know,
there's a lot more wrestling fans in this industry than you'd think. I think.
Oh really? Okay, cool.
I think I don't know. I think everyone keeps it quiet.
So I'm going to ask you this. There's a couple of things. Is like what. In your memory, what's your earliest memory of wrestling? I'll tell you mine.
Gosh. Like my earliest is like 80. Like
and by the way, this 80s, isn't Greco-Roman. Right? This is pro wrestling. This is pro. Yeah.
WWE now. Yeah. My absolute earliest is going to be like late 80s, right? Like, when I was little and it was, you know, Hulk, Warrior, Savage, people like that. It was that era.
And did you have a favorite wrestler growing up?
Probably Macho Man.
Oh, let me tell you something. Let's talk about that. So,
all right.
So WrestleMania 3 was the one with Andre and my favorite match ever. And I remember to this day, and it impacted me is Ricky the Dragon versus Macho Man.
Yeah.
That was and so like, you know, I'm kind of a historian. I read behind the scene. They choreographed that. Macho Man was very big on, you know, choreographing each nuance of it.
Very detail oriented.
Yeah. And you wouldn't, you know, think he's got this persona, whatever. But I mean, the guy just literally to the eye tooth. And that is still one of the greatest matches I've ever seen by far.
I would say it's probably one of the best WrestleMania matches ever, actually.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah.
I think my favorite, like from when I was younger in general, though, is I guess I was kind of basic because I really liked Austin. I was a big Stone Cold Mark back in the day.
We're using the lingo now. We're using Mark, kayfabe. Yeah, we're going to throw it all out there. Yeah.
Yeah. We're killing the business. I actually have a talk in the can. I have a really, really strong talk that I want to give sometime when we can do in-person events again. And it's basically about like why, if you want to be a better DevRel, go watch pro wrestling. Oh, yeah. Because it's incredibly instructive on a lot of levels, and I don't want to like give the whole thing away, but seriously, like everything I feel like I need to know about this job, in a lot of cases, I got it through watching pro wrestling.
Well, there's a swagger, right? If you think about like Ric Flair, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, he just walked down the aisle. He's just like, he had that flair, and he was just like, yeah, you know, and stuff like that. And then Austin just literally just like, you know, don't take it from anybody. Don't take any crap off anybody. It was the, you know, that, and it was like almost reality based wrestling, even though it was obviously it was fake. And
yeah,
stuff.
I mean, there was a lot. Like, I would probably not recommend Attitude Era WWE to anyone, especially. I mean, I don't know if I don't know how much I'd recommend WWE to anyone these days.
Yeah, agreed.
You want some good? Now you want something to watch? All Elite Wrestling.
Wednesday
nights on AEW.
Yeah,
AEW is real, real good.
Here's what I love about it. The indie spirit. It's almost like an open source thing, right? Think about all in, right? And this is, very similar to like what you did with Zerda DevOps. It's like, look, these guys were like, they put together and they're saying, you know what? You know, we're doing all the indies. Let's go together and do this thing, right? Yep. And they did it and they made a promotion out of it. And it's phenomenal. I mean, you had like, you know, Kenny Omega. I mean, these were guys that were in New Japan and all of that. But like, they were all independent,
talented individuals, right? Like any one of these people individually could have gone to like WWE and become one of the highest paid people in the company.
And they turned it all down because they it's the art of it, right? It's it's art of it. And now they have their own, you know, place. But like, I draw upon like, I watched a lot of ECW growing up as well. Like, you know, and I used to go to the, in Queens, I used to go to the, you know, the House of Hardcore over there, like, and stuff like that. And but like that time was amazing because it was revolutionary. And now what they're doing is revolutionary. Like, you know, think about the Bullet Club and stuff like that. It was like banding together and being like, okay, we're going to take this industry by storm. I love that.
It is great. And I think one of the really interesting parts about like what AEW is doing, and this is actually a really good analogy, I feel like, for like something that you can learn, a thing you can learn, right? If you want a business takeaway from this, or an anything takeaway, the really remarkable thing about AEW is that they have gone around and they have formed relationships with other promotions, right? So recently on the last, last week, week before last, but well, okay, this is airing in March. So they recently opened up a relationship with like New Japan Pro Wrestling, right? Which is a legitimately like world class. These people are huge, not only in Japan, but worldwide. And it's like, okay, now we have a working relationship with that company too. So like one of their guys is on our show, comes out of nowhere, right? They have another, there's a whole angle right now where you've got Kenny Omega reuniting with people he used to wrestle with in Japan that are on a completely different brand promotion now over at Impact Wrestling.
And Impact, which was started by his, like one of the people that he basically is almost like his uncle growing up, which is Don Callis.
But this isn't like, a lot of this is being played like as storyline, right? Like a lot of this is being played up as a, like, this is a story bit where there's a lot of parts about AEW that are hard to recommend to people that don't know wrestling that well. And one of the biggest ones is that AEW is very smarky, which is in to say, like, they play to an audience of people that get wrestling as kind of this weird meta art form. That's
smart. Smart means smart mark.
Smart mark.
Mark is somebody who's like really into the business of wrestling. So
yeah,
they'll be like glossary.
We're gonna hear so many captions and subtitles here. But what I think is, and the takeaway is this though, is like the big incumbent player here, right? WWE is extremely unfriendly to this idea of working together. They're peep. they're stars, they're performers, you know, those they're athletes, whatever you want to call them, they're sports entertainers, do not do things outside of that company, right? Like, and a lot of times they'll get fined for it, or they will lose opportunities because it's like, oh, you were seen on someone else's thing, right? Like it's a very closed loop. They don't acknowledge the rest of the world. And then over here, you've got kind of the smaller upstarts that are banding together and working together to promote each other. And I think that that's one of the real takeaways I have is that, like, you can think of the world as a zero-sum game or not. And in reality, the world is very rarely zero-sum, even in business, especially in technology. Like, if you are, I think one of the biggest things I do kind of at Lightstep is I spend a lot of time talking to people that don't work at Lightstep, right? Like, you can make a huge impact by working with people outside of your circle, working with people outside your company, you know, through things like open source, but also through, you know, do a podcast together, right? Like, do a stream together, write some docs together, create information, create stuff that is bigger than just like your walled garden, as it were. Do it for the community, because one, people notice, and two, like, you'll get better stuff that way, right? Like, you get better quality if you work together rather than kind of doing everything on your own.
It's same team, different company. You hear that adage all the time, and you know, I believe in it. You know what I mean? I'm like, you know, look, it, you know, it is what it is there. Like, if I would have started my show and made it just about a product and, you know, whatever. To me, what I think, and again, what I think is so successful about Deserted Island DevOps as well, is it's a way to kind of connect people from the community in a different way that's from the traditional methods that you normally have. You know, what is it? We go to a KubeCon, or we go to a, you know, a Black Hat, or whatever it might be. And then we break off. It's like, look, now we're all kind of isolated, sheltering, whatever. And this could be another, as a mechanism, you're playing Animal Crossing already, yeah. You know what I mean? Or, you know what I mean? So, like,
yeah, you might as well do something fun, productive. Right. I don't know.
Right. And so it's new ways of kind of, you know, staying community based, but not preaching and selling and, you know, all of that. To me, it was genius. And dude, I applaud you, because it was fantastic.
Thank you. None of it would have been possible without the extremely tireless efforts of my co-host Katie at the Cater Tot on the Twitters. But yeah, Katie really made that show what it was. I think I was just the guy with the stream deck punching buttons.
Shout out to you, Katie, good friend of mine as well. All right, so last question for you, and then I know we could probably talk wrestling for another hour and a half, but yeah, we'll do that in person someday. Maybe that's a good angle. Maybe a different show. We could just do wrestling and
DevOps. We'll do a wrestling podcast. Yeah. There's not enough of those in the world.
So what work are you most proud of, Austin?
Like, in my entire life? That's a tough one. When I was a kid, when I was a teenager, my dad forced me to stay in Boy Scouts because he thought it would be, I don't know, culturally be good for me, right? I think your parents always do that when you hit that surly teenager stage. And I really didn't I hated Boy Scouts, I'll be quite honest. I did not enjoy my time there a lot. But there's one thing I did that I actually was very proud of, and it's still there actually to this day. So because I didn't have a lot better to do, I decided to go for my Eagle Scout. And part of going for Eagle Scout is you have to do a service project, right? You have to do something that gives back to the community. And I decided to put a walkway in at the church I went to at the time, or the church I grew up in. And because there was a path that was very old and disused. And so I went out and I came up with the plans, and I raised some money, and I procured the materials, organized some people, and we went out and we built us a walkway from the church to the pastor's, wherever the pastor lives. I don't know. There's a name for it. Little house next to the church, let's say. And that is still there. I don't get home often for a lot of reasons, but when I do, I've gone by and it's still in one piece, and it's actually been maintained by people that have come after me. So I think overall in my life, that's probably the thing I'm most proud of, because everything else is kind of like, I mean, yeah, Deserted Island DevOps is great, but that's an idea anyone could have had.
Anybody could have had, but you were the one who executed it well, dude. You should just be humble on that one, man. That was great.
I am humble about it. I'm proud of it, yes, but like, there's a difference in my mind between like a something that you're gonna do. Like, I've never told that story, right? The one about the thing, because I'm proud of it, but I'm proud of it because it's not something that matters. It matters a lot to people sort of in the moment, but it's not something that there's no greater moral to this. It's just like, I saw a problem, I went and fixed it. And the things that I feel that contribute the most to the world are people solving those kind of problems. I think that if we spent more time on sort of the lower ego work of, you know, tending gardens, then we would have a society that was a lot better of a place to live in. So that got a little weird and preachy at the end, but
it's all good.
Take it in the spirit. I mean, take it in the spirit it was meant.
No worries. I appreciate you being on the show, man. This was great. You always have a spot anytime you want, man. This is a great talk. Thank you so much.
All right. Great for having me on. Thank you.